Hi, I'm Peter Keegan.
And I'm Laura Boswell. And there's the talented Mr. B on sound.
Are you looking to take the leap and become a working artist? The sort of artist that actually gets to make art and pay the bills at the same time? Well, Laura and I are both that sort of artist, and we've made this podcast to help you become one too.
So today, we're extremely lucky to be immersing ourselves in glorious colour. We're here in Cwmbran in South Wales, and we're visiting the factory of the ink and paint manufacturer Cranfield, who've been making colours for almost 100 years. With over three generations of experience, Cranfield has a unique insight and understanding of how colour can be made, and more importantly, how it can work for us artists. In this episode of Ask an Artist, we're delighted to be interviewing and picking the brains of Cranfield's Managing Director, Michael Crane, asking him to share not only his knowledge, but his love of colour. So, Michael, welcome to the podcast. And first of all, can you tell us a little bit about the history of Cranfield and how you came to be here?
Yes, thank you very much indeed. Well, we've been in this current factory here in Cwmbran since 1977, when industry was essentially shooed out of London. We then were in a lovely lane called Sugar House Lane. Fantastic. In Stratford in East London, actually where the Olympic Village is now. And they looked in the 1970s at getting lorries out of London, and they were trying to turn the Thames back to a more natural brown rather than blue, yellow, green, and whatever the colours were thrown into it. And that's really why we moved them. Strange enough, when my grandfather was towards the end of his life, he wanted to go back to his youth. And so my father and I took him back to Sugar House Lane. And we took him into the factory, which had then been converted into flats. And very kindly, it was between occupancies, we were allowed to go into the building.
Oh, wow.
And one of the flats was being restored. And we met the builders, and we went into what used to be my grandfather's office. And the builders explained that they had been fitting a kitchen. They'd been drilling into the walls to hang the cabinets up. And every time they drilled, out would come blue, green,
oh,
red.
Fantastic.
And they had no idea why. And they were really pleased that we had provided some sort of answers to this ghostly building that
That's fantastic.
Couldn't quite work out.
What a great story.
Yeah.
Because you're a family-run business.
We are
and
indeed.
You're from a generation of colour makers, aren't
you? Yeah, so that's really the history. And then the other part, the paint side of the business came from Wimbledon in the end, I think it was 2009. So that's been here for a shorter period of time. But that's a whistle stop explanation of how we ended up in
Cwmbran. So both your grandfather and father worked?
Yes. And I think I was tricked into the company, to be honest. I think something Freudian must have been happening because I studied printing and paint chemistry. And And my first job was with a paper company dealing with complaints. Hugely unsuitable job for a graduate. But I did that for a few years. And then my father said,
did you find the time you spent with a paper company useful when you came into the ink and pigment business?
You're right. You're right. Especially understanding the way that paper is hugely an influence for printmakers.
Yes, we should say at this point that this is really my baby with Cranfield, because as a printmaker, I'm fascinated by the products that you, and indeed use the products that you make.
Yeah.
And you're right, paper is a massive.
Yeah, and I think printmakers are fortunate in a way that printmaking papers still remain pretty good. They have lovely long fibres. Increasingly, papers generally, with the understandable desire to use recycled paper, the fibre length is getting shorter and shorter. And we produce oil-based inks primarily that dry through an element of absorption. And if the paper fibre is very short, then the lumen, which is the hollow part of the tube from the days when the fibre remembered that it was a tree, we need it to be nice and long to pull the varnish away. If it's very short, this is hugely technical for the boring for the introduction, but nonetheless, the very short fibre lengths mean that the inks don't separate, and you can have a situation that a crust will form, but there's too much oil trapped beneath, and then you run into drying issues. So
would you recommend for the printmakers and indeed other people who work on paper out there what they should be looking for in a paper?
I would say yes. They need to be using a paper which is a dedicated printmaking substrate. for unfortunately, a lot of colleges and universities with very tight budgets will be using commercial offset papers, if you like. And in them, there's large parts of Devon in terms of and Cornwall, in terms of China clay, fillers, and there's also very short fibre lengths. So that was a long answer to the question of did I enjoy paper?
but yes, it lives with me.
Yes.
So tell us a bit more about, you know, what you do in regards to, you know, running your business and kind of what you do day to day and what your business achieves.
Yeah. Well, we're really fortunate that we've got a hugely talented team. I think we have the great advantage of making both traditional oil-based inks. We make a range called Caligo, which is oil-based, but you wash it up with soap and water. We make artist oil paints. We make an artist studio. So there's always something which is interesting on any one day. And my role here is essentially one of technical sales. We don't have any sales team. And so we're also very fortunate that British products, because there's so few of us still standing, if you've lasted this long, there must be something good about you. And so it's a good time to export. And we send our product to Japan, to Australia, New Zealand, all across Europe, America, Canada.
Is there a real interest in the British product?
Yes, there is. I think that none of us in the UK would claim to be bulk manufacturers anymore. So the smaller independents, we're making a product well, we're using good raw materials, there's a sustainability to what we're sourcing. As a company, we did something called a life cycle analysis. And it makes, for us, hugely encouraging reading. We worked with a local university and the Welsh Assembly government, and we asked, are the packaging materials we use, are our processes, are our raw materials, are our formulations fitting for the expected lifespan of the product we're making? And we can put a lovely tick against that. And if I use an example, which will put us in a good and a truthful light, if you think of an insole that you buy for your shoe, it'll come in a plastic packet, which you'll put instantly in the bin. Well, you don't put your tube of paint or your tin of paint or tin of ink instantly in the bin. You've taken a small part from it. So our packaging matters. But going back to our insole, the very product will be thrown away within 6 months or a year. Whereas our products, our inks and paints, they will have, because they're packaged in suitable recyclable metal containers, they'll have a lifespan of 5, 10, 15 years. And then once they're printed and painted, they go on for 60, 70, 80 years. So yes, British products, they're made well, they're packaged well. For ourselves, we have a good life cycle analysis that we're content with. And that's a good news story, which travels well. So yeah,
absolutely. But you do quite a bit of travelling, don't you, and demonstrating?
Yes, I do. I'm, strange enough, I love being at home. So I'm probably the wrong person to go. And if colleagues are envious of me going to Chicago or Tokyo or wherever it is, I say, well, when you reach your hotel room and you open the door, the only question is, will the bathroom be on the left-hand side or the right-hand side? So I prefer to be at home. But having said that, it's the people I go to talk with and meet are always interesting, because we work in a fascinating world. It's a privilege to work in the art industry. And so whether I'm giving a talk in Tokyo or attending a conference in the States or whatever it is, I always enjoy it. And I think that in the art world, there is an understanding increasingly that actually, if we make good products and we're prepared to share our secrets and our experiences, it is for the greater good. And I think especially in printmaking, if I think back to 15, 20 years ago, printmaking was on its knees in many respects. It also had the risks of toxic question marks over it. Well, we've covered those problems. We now make inks that don't require strong solvents. Other improvements have been made. And we've collectively breathed new life into some of these disciplines.
So you think that's the kind of communication that manufacturers and suppliers and artists all have together?
I do, very much so. And I also think it's come at a time when printmaking through social media, there's much more of a fraternity that you look after one another. And if I think again, back to the advent of digital, a number of us were quite anxious at the time. And I remember having conversations with my father, and we both felt, well, digital technology, it's going to put paid to printmaking. People won't want to printmake anymore. And I think there was a period when, because, of course, digital, you can do things very big. So you can have a print which covers the side of the university. But actually, the better students want to return using digital technologies, and they want to interpret those into their printmaking work. So that now the best of the artists are combining the two.
Well, that's and, very interesting.
Yeah, and I think that events, conferences, many printmakers are so fascinated by the very means of printmaking. They probably never get around to making any prints, but they love it.
There's so much to talk about.
Whereas, Peter, you painters, you're more solitary. And I think that probably you live in the moment of putting paint from brush onto canvas, and that's what matters. These guys, the printmakers, they love the doingness of it.
Yeah, I think, because, of course, it's so there's such a structured process.
Yes, that's
right. And almost like the history of the craftsmanship in that true sense of the word and the skill set. Sort of passed down from generations. I think there is element of that with painters as well, but there seems to be a much stronger, I feel, tradition in ceramics, for example, woodwork and printmaking.
Yes, sure. I think there's sort of the tools and the materials and the processes. We all share them. We're all interested by that. So if I can ask you a little bit about some of the colours that you make. You use a range of pigments, natural, synthetic, things like that. Is that
we
right?
do. Three general sources of pigment: blacks, coming essentially from burning anything in insufficient oxygen, gives you soot, as you'll remember. Earth pigments, especially in the art world, they have great emotional resonance. They're very gritty. The wonderful thing is they're light fast. They do change from seam to seam. And so they have a function, but they don't always answer every question. Then the third grouping are synthetic organic, and they are produced with great precision, hugely reliable. Where possible, we try and use local and European manufacturers and suppliers. And so they're the three general descriptions of the pigments that we bring in.
And do you decide, do you stick to the same pigments all the time, or does that vary at all?
Yeah, no, a very sensible question. We, wherever possible, will stick to the same supplier. And the reason is there will be marginal, very small little differences between colours. The art world is hugely unregulated. There's no off-what or off-col or anything like that.
So there's no chart you have to adhere to.
No,
no.
So what I so, for example, alizarin crimson, does it describe the chemical or does it describe the colour?
Mm. And I find it's really problematic because I've bought the same colour alizarin, for example, from six different manufacturers, and they're all completely different. And then that's quite frustrating sometimes as an artist.
And when you're in the art shop, you don't necessarily have time to drill down into the detail on the label. Mm. So returning to your question about do we use the same supplier, we do. Occasionally, events take over. You may be aware some years ago there was enormous fire in a warehouse in Europe that took out 70% of titanium dioxide that was required by all manner of paint and colour manufacturers. So then we're all scrabbling around looking for alternatives, but we're very reluctant to do it. We try and stay with the same supplier so that you don't then have to change formulations.
And it always sounds sort of terribly romantic, natural pigments and things like that. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with synthetics.
No, not at all. And there may be ethical reasons, there may be political reasons why getting hold of lapis lazuli from Argentina is not, I beg your pardon, from Afghanistan, is not sensible or appropriate. So we'll use a chemical alternative. There are so many examples where historically we continue to use the name of Indian yellow, and yet it hasn't been made in its genuine form from feeding mango leaves to cows for an awfully long time, I'm pleased to say. So no, synthetics, very sensible, very sustainable.
So one of the things that I get asked a lot about is cleaning up, and it sometimes is the cause of arguments on social media. So can I ask you, as the expert, the safest way to clean up for you personally and also for the environment?
Yeah, that is a delicious question, and probably as the muckiest person at Cranfield, I'm forever washing up. I'm going to start with a really simple good news story concerning Caligo, which is our oil-based printmaking ink, both in a relief and an etching. It is oil-based. It's very lazy. So
this is what people know as safety wash.
Safe wash, that's it. And because it's oil-based, it prints with a lovely clear line. It stays where you put it, nice and lazy. You clean it up with a liquid soap and water. Now, we also make traditional products, and they need a mineral spirit, a turpentine or a white spirit. Mm-hmm. It would be wrong to suggest that all turpentine or white spirits are wicked and soap and water is somehow wonderful without failure. When we have students here at the factory, one of the first things that the old timers will teach them is how to wash their hands. Mm. And they'll point out that people who were washing their hands 100 years ago didn't have access to something we have today, which is really hot water. And we wash our hands in water which is far too hot. So we would urge, and you'd watch my colleagues, they would take soap, nothing particularly harsh, just ordinary soap, and they would wash their hands in cold water, first of all, because it won't open up the pores of the skin. If you open up the pores, the dirt and the ink and the colour goes further in. That's the first thing worth pointing out.
Because we all tend to think these days, the more you wash your hands, the better.
Yes, indeed. We are degreasing our skin far too much. But turning right to the beginning of the day, when you get in, put some barrier cream on. So all over the factory here and on my desk is a little pot of barrier cream. Keep applying barrier cream. Don't be nervous of a good healthy dollop of dirt, so don't be forever rushing to the sink. Obviously, if you're handling a canvas or a paper, you need to wash your hands, but don't be forever doing it. When you do wash your hands, as I say, use a sensible soap, nothing too harsh, and don't use very hot water. The other thing worth pointing out, at least I feel is important, is there are a number of products, cleaning solvents, that smell wonderfully and have pretty labels. And this is true not only in our own art world, but generally. But many of them, if you look at the label, they still contain a hydrocarbon solvent.
Oh, right. Okay.
Now, the name will suggest the product's made in Dingley Dell by Pixies. And yet the reality is it contains a hydrocarbon. In their defense, the hydrocarbon is very heavy. So it won't evaporate. You're not breathing it in. That does tend to mean they're quite greasy. So actually they don't really cut an oil ink or an oil paint as a traditional turpentine or white spirit. So I probably would say that don't throw the turpentine or white spirit out instantly. Cautiously used, careful use of rags, using disposable rubber gloves if you have any form of dermatitis. Don't allow long exposure to your skin. But that small, careful use of a good solvent is better than...
Yes, because I tend to use white spirit.
Yeah, that's preferable, I would suggest, to the careless use of other solvents, because it's actually often not the solvent itself which causes the problem. It's the fact that it's removed the skin's natural protection, and then people become sensitized to all manner of perfectly innocent things. The next thing they touch, which may be, I don't know, vinegar, or it may be some other kitchen product or a household item, they can then be sensitized to that because the solvent has removed the natural protection.
Now, some people I know use vegetable oils in clearing up.
Yeah.
I daren't do that because I know I would have it over every print the second I open the tube.
Well, I'm going to be very controversial now and say that vegetable oil doesn't clean, it dilutes. Right. You're adding more of what's already in there. So you make vast quantities of a very weak paint or a very weak ink. You then have to put it into newsprint or into rags and you send the whole lot for landfill. Now, yes, I'm not sure that's particularly environmentally friendly or helpful. But nor is it an accurate description of the word cleaning. It is extending. So you're making a very, very large quantity of an oily mess and you're not emulsifying it and it needs to go somewhere.
So in fact, it would be best to clean discreetly with some soap and water.
Yes. Some products won't, in fact, emulsify. If you're using a traditional ink, for example, you'd have to use some kind of solvent. But the quantities that people are using sometimes I see of vegetable oils are quite large, far, far larger than the amounts of soap and water you'd require for the same amount of ink.
Mm. So you've just given myself, Laura, and the talented Mr. B a fantastic tour around your fabulous factory and workshop, seeing how you go about making your products. And you make a range of different types of printing inks. So do you have any recommendations for those people out there who are beginners who are looking to get into this? And what I'm interested in personally is that difference between oil-based and water-based. Yeah. Are there any differences in the outcome and the way that we should be using them?
Yes, water-based, whilst we make water-based products, probably our heart isn't in it. We know it forms a purpose. It's hugely good and helpful for splash it all over, beginner level, big, chunky, bold colours. We were talking earlier about the lumens of paper in paper fibres. Water-based will tend to travel along those fibres further than oil-based product. It's called filamentation, if you look at it under a microscope.
So this is how the ink seeps.
It goes into the paper, and a water-based ink will travel further. It'll take the colour with it because it travels quite quickly down the lumens of the paper. So you get a feathery effect. So water-based is there. It's good in relief. It's good for entry level for people that want
it's
to
good
try.
Good in a class where you want quick drying time, something like that. I use water-based when I'm teaching.
Indeed.
For that very reason.
And the pupils can take the work home with them that night under their arm. Yeah. But I would suggest, so that is probably for 10% of the serious printmaking market. The rest will want to look at an oil-based of one description or another. The traditional, simply the way things have worked out historically, we have a much bigger colour range in our traditional relief and in our traditional etching. And it's what so many professional printmakers grew up with. So as a consequence, they like the large colour range. They're careful using solvents that actually it fits their function and their requirements perfectly. However, there is now the advantage of the Caligo product, which is oil-based. It will print, as it is oil-based, sharply, beautifully, with exactly the same characteristics as an oil-based. It's just at the end of the shift, at the end of the day, you wash up with liquid soap and water. It also means for etchers that they can, I'm not suggesting etchers are a mean lot, but they watch their finances and the tarlatan or scrim cloth, which is required for wiping the plate clean, or at least wiping the non-image area clean before you print, it gets covered in ink, as you'd suggest. That too can be washed out with soap and water.
Oh, so
and
it just helps that.
Yeah, indeed. And you can hang it on a clothesline or over a radiator, and you can reuse that.
But also, I find as a printmaker, I have both your Caligo and your traditional range, and I dot between the two. They're perfectly compatible.
They're perfectly interchangeable.
Yeah. And I found, I was saying the other day that I'm a sort of real extender freak. Anyone who knows my work will know that, and actually I dot between the two extenders, the traditional extender and the Caligo extender, because one, I find the traditional one being slightly stiffer is great for sheets of flat color. The Caligo one is slightly softer and it's great for manipulating. So you've got a real flexibility there.
Indeed, and as you say, they're entirely interchangeable. The only thing is, obviously, the more of the traditional you add to the Caligo, the common denominator in terms of cleaning.
But then I'm a white spirit girl.
So
So you make oil paint as well.
We
so
do.
For the artists like me, the painters, you have an artist range and a sort of a more working student range.
Yeah.
What's the difference between those
two? Well, that's
two?
Interesting. Again, we were saying earlier, weren't we, that there's no one that regulates terms in paint, which is a big problem, or in colour generally in the art world. So these terms really are regulated by us, ourselves and our conscience. And so the artist oil range really would be the highest quality pigments in an oil, very simple formulations. We don't make a student level because that is, or an economic range, which are often filled out with other things. The only two we do are an artist oil and then a studio. And the studio is the same pigment choice, largely speaking, but simply the pigment content is a little lower. Mm-hmm. So they would be the choices that we make. Historically, again, with nobody regulating this industry, I would suggest that anyone that's looking to change paint or explore a new paint manufacturer would take some time looking at the label. There's an awful lot of information on a label. Mm. And it'll tell you, it ought to tell you the series number. The series number is defined by us. If there's 48 colours in a range, well, feasibly, you could have 48 prices. But what we do is we clump them together. Mm. And so you can, you'd be looking for anomalies. Is a pigment which, or a colour which ought to be expensive in series one, and which is the cheapest entry level? And if it is, you'd ask yourself, why? Mm. Then you'd be looking at the pigment reference, the pigment number that ought to be on there, whether it's transparent or opaque. So there's an awful lot of information on a good paint label.
To read up and learn. It does.
Yeah. And again, if you were to follow the link to our website and then on to the colours, you'll find each of them will list the pigment that's in there. And it's worth researching.
It's really nice hearing how reassuring it is the difference between the artist range and the studio range. There's not a huge difference. Mm. I get asked a lot, and people kind of panicking, thinking they're not buying the artist range,
and
really worrying
about it. When you're setting it, when you're starting out, it's a big plunge to stock.
Indeed. And for some, the artist oil is so strong that it's almost like a concentrate.
Yeah, it is. It's a heck of a wallop.
Which is why printmakers, the biggest sale is black and then colours. For you oil painters, the biggest is white. And so an artist oil actually may not be fitting for many artists. They may choose a few punchy colours from the artist range, and then a studio range will actually be, for the bulk of what they're painting, they can hit the ground running with it in terms of strength.
I right in thinking that as well as selling colours singly, you do packs as well?
We do.
Find those are popular? People like having a...
We do. Yeah, they're packs of six, and we use them both on paints and on inks. It's a very interesting point. We were sceptical because we thought, well, we supply relatively professional products at the higher end of the industry. Why would sets be of interest to our target audience? And actually, we were really quite surprised. And actually, when we now reflect back on it, we think, no, that makes sense. By putting in a box, a starter kit, you actually take some of the fear away for the customer because it can be quite alarming.
Very much so. There's so many colours on a rack, and you just know, you already mentioned all those different bits of information on a label. And if you're able to helpfully say, well, here's a good start, it does take up that worry and frustration.
And I know nothing about automotive, but on occasions when I've needed something for the car and you go into a genuine motor factor, and you ask, you know, can I have this particular spark plug? And then they want clarification. Did you want the cross buttock securing valve? And you suddenly feel totally inept and humiliated. And I think the starter kits, these boxes, are a way for people not to have to ask too much. Someone else has done the choice for them. They can take it to the till.
I think you're right. And I think also I find with students, the thing is you teach a class and people are raring to go. Yeah. And frankly, they want to do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
If not the later in the evening. So the idea that you can get a box and I can get started, I think is a really good point.
So you also offer a range of sort of additives and mediums and things you can add to paint and ink, which changes the property and the way it behaves and the way it looks. What sort of things do you offer then?
Yeah. Well, let's start with paints first of all. What one can achieve with paints, it is limited. Whatever the medium, it can't do more than one thing. It can either make it glossier or matter. It can't make it both. It can either make it thicker, more viscous, or thinner. It can't do both. It can make it dry more quickly or not, whatever it happens. So any medium will do one or possibly two of those things. Now, painters, they tend not to add too much energy to the paint. They may work it a bit with a palette. So the beauty of some of the mediums are that they can extend And if you, I would, this comes from a man who's never knowingly read any instructions in his life for anything. But I think when it comes to mediums, read the instructions, because when you extend and you make weaker, do you want it to become more glossy or do you want it to remain muted? You need to make sure that you read and you know exactly what you're going to achieve. But the mediums are there in all sorts of forms to fulfill all sorts of functions, so that when you paint, you can either accentuate the brush marks or reduce them or whatever it is. On inks with printmaking, the choices are somewhat more limited because, of course, painters are applying to film weight in the millimeters and printmakers, you're applying in the microns. And so you're not doing anything to the texture. And so what you have to hand are more limited. Mm. You can extend with an extender, which is a colourless ink. So it's the same body as the rest of the range. It just is not going to impart any colour.
It's interesting how people are confused by this. I'm often asked about extender. People don't really know about extender. Yeah. And yet it is such a useful
thing. It is useful. So it will weaken, it'll move the pigment particles further apart. It'll weaken it, but it'll still behave like an ink because it is a colourless ink. You could then, if you wanted, didn't want to use an extender, you could use an oil. Now, with an oil, it will extend it. It'll make it weaker, but it'll reduce the viscosity quite markedly. Mm. Or you might wish to use a gelled-based product, a wiping compound or a tack reducer. As the name suggests, that will reduce the stickiness, so it's useful for etchers. But whereas the extender and the oil are adding more of what's already in there, these gelled products are introducing an entirely new phase. They're introducing a solvent, essentially Vaseline.
Right.
And so
this is the tack reducer.
So you have to be very careful you don't add too much, because the solventy component will actually begin to affect the ink.
This is where I start to panic because I realise what I do in my workshop. Well, I might use, for example, if I were doing something with a lot of extender in it, I might put a smidge of tack reducer in to stop it being stringy. You get a nice kind of flow to it, but not too much.
I love the word smidge. I think that I'm a big fan of the smidge because I think you're right. You don't need to be adding. But if I ask you a quiz question, your start of a tender, I've spoken about extenders, I've spoken about oils, we've mentioned tack reducer. There is a fourth additive. It's free, it's in every studio, but many printmakers don't add it. Now, it should be the first thing they try before they go for the pot or the tin or the tube. Any idea what the... I've turned the tables on you, haven't I?
Elbow grease.
Yes, you're right. Work it up a bit of energy, because inks are hugely thixotropic. Mm. That means they're like butter. Mm. You put energy in, the tack and the viscosity come down, especially the viscosity. You stop putting energy in and the viscosity comes back up again. Mm. Now, that's why people use heated plates. But as I say, often overlooked is a bit of elbow grease.
Well, I always advise people, especially when using extender, that working them a lot on the lino is really important to even things out. And I think, you know, that whole working the roll a bit can't be underestimated. Yeah.
Well, my colleagues, I have two technical colleagues here, Paul Lee and Sarah Carnline. Sarah looks after the States and Paul with me here in the UK. And we often go to universities. And it's interesting, if you're with a university for a day, you'll see when you come in at 9 in the morning or 9:30 and it'll be relatively cold. And you'll see the students rush to soften the inks with masses of gel. And the first print they get is nice. But if you are there at 11 o'clock or midday, they can't understand why everything's filled in. There's no definition. So again, heat is hugely important. It's also hugely important for drying at the end of the day as well. But the rheology, the science of how things flow, hugely influenced by putting a bit of energy.
But it's interesting, this whole business, because I think as a printmaker, certainly as a liner cut printmaker, inking is always seen as, you just put a bit of colour on. And actually, I would argue that the inking side of it for me is more technical and more, almost more important in a way than the cutting.
The
inking is such a variable and complex business.
I remember as a young man visiting the workshop of Marcus Bevan. And he was a printmaker that did work for the National Trust in the 1980s. He did all the illustrations in the National Trust handbook. And if he was working on a print, you would first of all have that lovely bacon and egg sound of the roller when you put up a fresh thing, a tin of ink. And I would sit there whilst he'd be rolling up, and it would go on and on and on. And we would be chatting, but he would be rolling. There'd be no prints for 20 minutes or so because he was getting it to a viscosity and a heat that then he'd then do the rest of the day, then get rid of that as a variable. But yes, it's very important, hugely.
And can we just touch on dryers as well? Because drying ink is another thing that I get asked about a lot.
Yeah.
So there are two that I know of, this manganese and this cobalt.
Yeah, indeed. And let's start then with environment, which is the third. The way, and this is true both for artist paints in oils and printmaking oils, essentially there are some key components that will make an oil-based product dry well and sensibly. Oil-based products are not instant dryers, so we need to be realistic about that, but they're slow and they're steady, and once they are dry they can't be returned. Now an oil-based product needs the incentive to let go of the volatile components, and that incentive is warm, dry air that has capacity to take moisture. So the air in the studio needs to be warm, but the dryness, the low relative humidity, is actually even more important than the temperature. And as temperature drops, the air's capacity to hold moisture goes down too, which is why we see our breath on a cold day. Mm. You see the steam. Cold air becomes very easily saturated. And the sadness is that so many studios are not heated at night for understandable economic reasons. But actually, as the temperature goes down, time stands still. Mm. And you'll remember your parents, if they were gloss painting when the day when paintbrushes were more expensive than they are today, that at the end of the day doing the door frame, they would take the gloss paintbrush and they'd stick it in a jar of water at night. And in the morning, they'd shake the water off and they'd carry on drying. Essentially, the water in the jam jar represented 100% humidity.
Right.
There was no capacity for anything to leave the drying or the gloss paint. A studio at night, especially if it's in a damp area or it's been heated during the day by something which produces moisture, such as a gas, portable gas stove or paraffin, then the temperature goes down, relative humidity goes up. But actually it's worse than time standing still, because if we allow an ink to start to dry, but then we don't give it the environment where drying can continue, the crust that forms on the ink becomes self-defeating. That it prevents oxidizing, it's the same for oil paint. Mm. Yes, that you then seal the surface, and it stops further oxidation getting in. So, because we know that's going to happen to a greater, we hopefully a lesser extent, but we know it's going to happen. That's where dryers come in useful.
Right.
Now, I ought to say, we've mentioned that we like warm air, we like dry air, we also like moving air. So even the best of conditions, the area above the sheet will become saturated. So with an open window or a fan or something, if we can get that air to move, then we're looking good. But we may want to add a dryer. Now, these are catalytic dryers, metallic salts, and when they are in an ink, especially an ink, although you can put dryers in oil paints as well, they help the oxidation continue beneath the surface. However, the metallic salt needs, and cobalt and manganese are examples. Mm. Cobalt is used less and less these days because of health question marks when it's used in an atomized form in the automotive industry, car spray. So not really our worry, but in some years' time, it's probably going to disappear completely. So we'll be using other metallic dryers. Now, they need to be put in a solvent so they can be put in the ink. And commonly they're put in a hydrocarbon.
Nice.
So a clean white spirit or a clean petrol, if you like. Now, you can get to the point very quickly when if you're adding too much dryer, the solvent which is carrying the metallic salt, the manganese naphthenate or whatever it is, does more harm than the dryer does good.
And so it cancels it out.
Yeah. So that's why we'd say 5% dryer maximum.
But you make a manganese dryer in a wax space.
We do, yeah.
So which I've just started using.
Yeah.
Actually,
and that fulfills two functions. The manganese will be there as the dryer, but the wax, the natural lanolin wax, will rise towards the surface, the drying surface, and it leaves a clear top layer, so it sort of provides a scuff resistance, but it's not too waxy to repel further colours that you may want to overprint, but it gives a protection as well as drying at the same time.
And cobalt, I find, will give a shine to the ink.
Yes.
Which, I mean, I much prefer manganese because it doesn't give that shine.
It is more muted. Yeah.
But then again, it's worth remembering if you want to shine in a particular part of your print, then you can vary your dryer and achieve that.
Indeed, indeed. And again, it's one of these areas where there are no rights or wrongs. You've got to try it and find out what you are content with, what you like, the results you get. Mm. And if it's right for you, then stick with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So protecting and preserving artwork for a lot of us is a crucial part. We want our prints and paintings to be lasting, you know, hundreds of years and hopefully beyond. So what sort of suggestions do you have in regards to keeping work protected and then also into framing work and the type of glass used for framing?
Okay. Well, strange enough, the protection of days gone by, things like Damar varnishes have rather fallen into disuse. Disuse is not a right word, is it? But you know what I mean. They've fallen from grace. So these days, people will tend to be painting and that'll be the end of it. Mm. In a sense, if you're using good products, the longevity of the work comes from the fact that you're using light-fast pigments, you're using varnishes which have been well chosen and well prepared exclusively and particularly for artistic applications. Mm. And so those sort of things will give you assurance. And then I think it's worth at every stage making sure you do things properly. So, Peter, for you as a painter, making an excellent ground, priming well, remembering that three thinner coats is better than one dirty great thick coat, allowing the primed surface to dry in natural light. Don't put it under the stairs or against a wall when you can get a yellow transient chromophores, they're called. A colour will appear for a while. Mm. The good news is they'll disappear if you put it back into natural light again. But a really good foundation. Painting in good conditions in the studio environment that we were talking about. Mm. Even if you're plein air, that you're bringing it back in and you're storing it somewhere, well, it's that kind of behaviour, making sure obvious things like it shouldn't be dropped, don't drop it. In terms of the framing, one of the main functions of a good frame is to keep it dimensionally stable. And so that is really important. The prettiness of it doesn't matter so much as long as it's holding the canvas taut. Glass, I'm slightly cautious. I'm not an expert in this at all, but some of the fears of UV-resistant glass, or at least protective glass, what does the customer intend doing with the knowledge that is UV-protective to an extent? Does it mean they're going to hang it in direct sunlight because it ain't going to do anything there? So I think that it's a general care. I had the sad conversation recently with somebody who has inherited an heirloom and it had been stored over a radiator. A most eminent artist from a family who have got a very good art collection, but somehow that hadn't got through, that it wasn't the best place, and a big problem of cracking. Mm. And paints do crack.
Yeah.
And whether they're oil-based or acrylic, acrylic has dined out, I would suggest, on a reputation that probably it didn't deserve until now, because no one had seen a 70-year-old acrylic paint.
Of course.
Now we're seeing they do go brittle and they do crack and they do yellow. And these are the facts of life. So I think that preparing the painting well, storing it well, framing it well are really important. We have the sadness again of some of the painters of the 70s and 80s who were for their time hugely experimental and expressive. They had low budgets at the time and they used, you know, household emulsions, which is okay to an extent. But the bad news is they use household emulsions on which they then used oil paints. And, you know, you'll remember the bimetallic strip that we learned about in physics at school in the kettle, those different metals riveted together. And as they expand and contract with the changing heat, they will bend. And a domestic paint and an artistic paint, they will have different expansions and contractions.
I must post on the show notes, we have an absolutely classic example of this. We have Mr. B's mum painted by Mr. B's grandfather.
Did she mind being painted at the time?
She hated it because she said it was everything that her father thought she should be and nothing about what she was. But we have this portrait at home, which is really beautiful paint. I love it to bits, but parts of it are falling off. And Jim, we suspect, slapped on the household paint and then oil paint over the top. So I'll take a photo of that and pop that in the show notes. So
well, I think what I do is when I hand a painting over to a customer and a client, I will always tell them,
don't put it over
a radiator, don't put it in direct sunlight, don't put it above a fireplace and all those things, just to remind them. And, you know, you'd hope people wouldn't, but that sort of handover care, I still make sure that that message is got through just to make sure that it can be passed down, hopefully for the next few generations, and it is in one piece.
So can I just ask you, as the expert, do you have any advice, when, obviously to buy your products, but outside of that, when it comes to buying paints or inks, is expensive always the best way to go? Are there definite things you should avoid?
That's a really awkward question in a way, because I have to then talk about competitor products. But I will try and be as responsible as possible and say nothing which is derogatory about them. Our competitor products, which largely are made from sewage and boiling small children. look, if it's a good, reputable manufacturer, they'll be making a good paint. I think I would be concerned for the... I certainly wouldn't touch a here-today-gone-tomorrow brand name which suggests it's been made in the Far East and it has been bought in. Some of them are knock-off products, so they'll have a name similar to a well-known brand. Yeah. And they're so obvious that it's made from very different raw materials. The methods that are used are really wholly unsuitable for an artistic endeavour. So a long-winded answer to your question. What would I do? I would use a known manufacturer. I would do a bit of research. I would look at the website of the manufacturer and to see that they've got good, suitable mills. If you don't read that they've got the equipment, then I'd be questioning, well, how is it being made? In terms of cost, and this is blatant promotion of our own products, I think we'd see our Artist Oil, for example, as an aspirational brand where people are using a mainstream good product, but they want something better within at a price that they can justify. And so because we also make the studio oil as well, it means somebody could buy 80% from our studio oil and they could buy the remaining 20% from the artist oil. So that would be an answer on the paint side. On inks, again, your choices are either a dedicated printmaking ink or a commercial ink. And commercial inks are not suitable. They are, many of them...
When you say commercial ink...
So an ink which would be used by your local, Pronto Print or something like that.
Right,
you
okay,
know, it comes in often a vac pack tin. You struggle to open the thing. It smells of hydrocarbon. Commercial inks need us to set very quickly. And then it almost doesn't matter if they cure. So if you think of a newspaper, for example, It sets so that you can read it. But if you rub it mm-hmm. weeks after, it'll still come off on your hands. Mm. Because there's a big difference in drying between setting and curing. Whereas a printmaker needs to take a product from us, it must have nothing which is particularly volatile. It must have be a relatively simple formulation so that once it's dried, the linseed will, what we call, it's a through dryer, so it'll all turn to solid, and then that'll give you longevity. And really, that is only available from a product which is made for a printmaker with a printmaker in mind.
I sometimes get asked by people who sort of say, oh, well, I've got paint. Can I add something to it to make it into a printing ink? And I always say no.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I'm quite right. I know yeah. there are things that purport to change things into printing inks.
Yeah. I think you're right to say no. Mm. Strange enough, they are cousins. A good oil ink will be a cousin of a good printmaking ink. But what you can't replicate, to change that ink into a paint will be impossible. Mm. To change the paint into an ink would need you to fiddle around and add so much that it would be such an unwieldy formulation.
People often talk about turning acrylics into
paint. Yeah. Well, a good news story would be you can turn acrylic into a screen print.
Ah,
ink.
That's maybe where it
so comes we from. Make a screen print gel, mm-hmm. which you can add probably 50-50 to an acrylic, because the screen print film will be thinner than the artist needs when painting with acrylic. So we take a screen print gel and we add it to an acrylic paint, and you can get a perfectly good result. That's popular with schools and colleges because they don't have to have two ranges.
Of course. Mm.
But generally, I would be saying use yeah. the product designed
liner,
for your
design.
But for
liner, which is kind of my field,
yeah.
you wouldn't
use
recommend
the product.
Using an acrylic?
No, I wouldn't. I would use the product intended for your discipline. Mm. Quite apart from anything else, acrylic paint, if you try and roll acrylic paint, you'd get an orange peel effect. It reticulates. Mm. Mm. And unless that's the leopard skin spot result you wanted, use the product which has the correct rheology, the science of how things flow. Each of these products have been designed for the discipline.
Well, that's what I mean. I was really impressed that when you took us on the tour around your factory, that you rigorously test every single ink and colour to a range and depth I never knew that could be possible, to sort of where you kind of go for all of this so there aren't any kind of problems of it, you know, peeling or having to being too grainy and
well,
so
Peter, on. Well,
Peter,
that's because we enjoy making ink and paint, and it comes as an absolute novelty to us and delight that people want to use it. Because if you make colour, it is the centre of your world. And we have the experience, if we attend a trade fair or an event, and with colleagues, I'm going to be at NAMPTA in Chicago in the spring. We're going to be in Puerto Rico at Southern Graphics, which is a big printmaking festival in February. And whilst you're there, it's got over the front door the National Art Materials Conference, and it's the centre of our world. Mm. And then the sadness is at the end, when we're packing up, they're putting up the next sign, and it'll be Hardware Week or, a clothing manufacturer's yeah. exhibition. So it is the centre of our world. We take great pleasure from making really good paints and inks, and the tests, as you've seen yourself, range from the very technical to the really very artisan and historic, but it's all part of the package of giving an ink or a paint, which is the same as you had last time, and we trust that what you'll want next time too.
Yeah, and like you can also sense the pride from your team as well, and the passion that you know from the guys milling in the factory to the ladies in the office, there's this real kind of passion, enthusiasm, which is so lovely for this, you know, for a local British company. I think it's fantastic.
The passion is stretched when it's taken home on people's shoes accidentally when, and goes across lounge carpets.
So as our takeaway this week, where can people find out more about your products and where to buy them?
Fine, well, I'm going to suggest people go to our website, which is cranfield-colours.co.uk. And there they will find not only retailers, they can press the filter button and find paint suppliers and ink suppliers. They'll also find a lot of resources. So plenty of interviews and blog posts and technical work that we've done in the past. But also through hello@cranfield-colours.co.uk. We love getting questions. The more obscure, the better. And we're delighted to answer them all.
So, Michael Crane, thank you ever so much for talking to us and sharing all your information.
No, thank you. It's been a genuine pleasure. Thank you.
So remember, all of you, thank you for listening. You can catch up on all the information we've covered today and all the other podcasts we've recorded on our website, which is askanartistpodcast.com. And if you belong to an art group, please do share your excellent taste in podcasts and spread the good word all about us. And that'll keep us helping you.